Go ahead and open in prayer, and then I'll just turn it over to Simon and Benjamin. Father, we thank you for this day, and Father, thank you for all these teens and college students that showed up here today. Father, I pray, Lord, that through our discussion and through our questions, Father, that you would be honored and glorified. And Father, I pray, Lord, that our minds would be challenged and that we would prepare ourselves to be able to defend our faith as we talk to students at school, students on the campus, and even ones in our own family. Father, we pray, Lord, for your blessing upon them. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen. Amen.
All right, so this is how the Q&A session works. You ask the questions, and I deflect them and hand them all over to Benjamin to answer. So, do we have any questions then? We've got about an hour or so for questions.
Everyone has questions.
We're going to have some
questions. The question is who has the courage to ask the first one?
Exactly. Any questions out there? Yes, sir.
Me and my parents on the way to church this morning, we were talking, you know, but what's your guys' opinion about what worldview really is? Because there's the worldview of, like, based on your religion, whether, like, you know, because you're Hindu, Christian, whatever,
agnostic,
yeah, or atheist, you know, what you believe on morals and stuff like that, or, you know, during our Civil War, you know, the North believed one thing on slavery, the South believed something different, and I believe that that's part of their worldview. So what is your definition of worldview?
That's a good question. I think that a worldview is are basically it's the way in which you view reality. That's what a worldview is. The way you perceive how things really are. Now, you can be a religious person, and so if you have a religious background, that's going to inform the way you understand creation, you understand what man is and how he's meant to act in that kind of system. So you could have a Hindu worldview or a New Age worldview. I don't think there's any person who's without a worldview. Okay? The person who says, I don't have a worldview, that's his worldview. He's the I don't have a worldview kind of guy. Okay, because nobody is divorced from creation and reality, and we might be very skeptical about reality, you know. So when you get to college, you'll hear some students say things like this: "How do you know you're not in a dream?" and this kind of nonsense, you know that they sort of promote this kind of skepticism, and that's a worldview in a sense. So some people's worldviews are very much consistent with a particular religious system or belief system, but a lot of people in the culture in America have these mixed worldviews where they're combining various things. It might be they'll pinch a few things from the Christian worldview, they might have some things that they agree with atheist and agnostic, and then they just sort of mix it together. And this isn't something which a lot of people are consciously thinking about. They absorb a lot of these ideas and concepts from the culture they live in. Mm-hmm. They get it from the media. They get it from the books they read. They get it from partly from their education, from their cultural upbringing. And so sometimes when you're speaking to some people, a good strategy to engage them is to try and ask them questions to try and get them to explain their worldview. You know, what is it they believe? What do they believe about creation? What do they believe about man? What do they believe about man's need for salvation, or even if that's a question? And then relating to your question on the debate between what happened in this country in the Civil War, because it seems like at that time most of America was Christian, and you had people in the North at odds with people in the South. I'm reading a very, very good book at the moment. It's by a guy who was, I'm told, one of the experts in the world on slavery. His name is Eugene Genovese, And the book is called The Southern Front. And in this book, he's talking about the very thing that you asked me. What is the situation when you had Christians in the South who were advocating slavery and Christians in the North who weren't? And what I find very interesting in that is that there was a lot of debate in order to justify slavery as a particular practice. So contrary to what a lot of people have said, the folks in the South actually had justification for what they thought was a legitimate argument for slavery on the basis of their view of economics, okay, and on the basis of the fact that the Bible, nowhere in the Bible does the Bible actually say slavery is wrong, okay? So they actually made an argument for slavery based on the scriptures, okay? Now, there was a furious debate between the intellectuals in the South and the Christian leaders in the South and the intellectuals in the North. So there's some very famous debates that went on between some of the leading theologians at Princeton University and some of the leading intellectuals in the South over, you know, as Christians, how do we run our society and govern our society? And a lot of the Southern intellectuals have pointed towards Europe and saying, look, what we have in Europe with the industrialization, there were a lot of people in poverty and people were struggling. And they said to me, oh, the reason why you're having this is because of the economic system, which is based off of a system that exploits people. And in a system where you have slavery, you can actually provide a safety net for these people. So now, whilst I strongly disagree with their arguments, they're making arguments nonetheless. Okay. So you'll see that a lot of people say, well, the Civil War in America, this is what I've heard from folks, and I'm certainly not an expert, is about states' rights. And whilst to some extent that's true, this book, and I'll give you the details, it's an amazing read. Really is, because this guy does a very, very thorough analysis of the discussions that were going on between the intellectuals in the North and the intellectuals in the South who were arguing, because both were Christians. And I just think that the arguments coming from the folks in the South were just wrong on the basis of the biblical account. Remember, there's a difference between people tend to think of slavery in America in the way that you think of slavery in the Bible. Okay. The kind of slavery you had in America was called chattel slavery, where basically the slave that you own is your property, like my belt or my fishing rod, and so that's a different view of what slavery was. In the Bible, slavery in the Bible, there was different kinds of slavery. Okay, so if this man here with the maroon shirt, what is your name, sir?
Levi.
If Levi was living back in biblical times, and let's say, for example, he had started a business and he had borrowed some money from some person and his business went bankrupt, well, how could he pay back his debt? What he would do in order to pay back his debt is he would go to the person to whom he owes money and would say to him, look, I'm going to work for you. So it's sort of that he would submit himself and work for this person almost as a slave to pay back his debt. Okay, so people would enslave themselves to owners for the sake of paying debt, for example. A lot of slavery in biblical times was you would have people as slaves for a certain number of years, and then the slaves were given the freedom to leave, and then the slaves could choose either to leave or to stay.
Culture of America.
Yeah. And so that kind of slavery is called bond servant slavery, okay? Where the slave who, having served the person he's for, his master for so many years, gets to choose whether he wants to leave or stay with the slave master, okay? And so and what's fascinating in the Bible, in the Gospel or in the Book of Romans, Paul talks about us becoming enslaved to Christ, and the word that he used there is bond servant. So he says of you and I that when we become saved, what we're doing is we're choosing to stay enslaved to Jesus, because everybody's enslaved to something. The only question is, what are you enslaved to? Because to be enslaved to money or success or an idol of whatever kind it is not a good thing. To be enslaved to Christ is a good thing. So a lot of people just assume that the kind of slavery you had in America was exactly like the slavery you have in the scriptures. Now, I think that Christianity teaches, it doesn't say slavery is wrong. What Christianity ultimately does do, I think, is that it undermines slavery, because it's very, very strong in talking about how slaves should respond to their masters, and how people who are masters, who become Christians, how they respond to their slaves. And if a slave master would treat his slaves like Christ treats them, and vice versa, you for the most part have the dismantling of that system. Okay. This evening I'm going to be starting off my talk by reading, I can't give this away, I'm going to be reading, you can try and think of who this is, I'm going to be reading from a book from a chap who was a Christian chap who was responsible for the dismantling, him and a few others, of slavery. So it's a good question that you ask. So the question you asked, the second question you asked on slavery, is a bit more complex. And so there you had a dispute between Christians of the same worldview. And so if we, I encourage you to read, look into that, and I can give you that book to read. It's a fascinating read. It's a very interesting read.
And there's, interestingly, there's, I don't know if you, any of you guys know who Wendell Berry is. He's a pretty prominent American thinker right now. He's been called a prophet. He's been compared to C.S. Lewis. He's a Kentucky farmer. And he wrote a book that I'm reading right now called The Unsettling of America. And he actually says that in the beginning of the first chapter, he says that today, post-industrial revolution, that all Americans are actually in a slavery system, economically speaking, because we're enslaved to, like Simon was saying, we're slaves to money, we're slaves to consumerism, we're slaves to buying things and getting things, and but you go all the way back to the American Revolution, and the founding father and Jeffersonian America, Thomas Jefferson, viewed America as small, independent farming communities across the country, and there were property owners, and we didn't pay property taxes or income taxes. The government couldn't come in and take your property. That was the beauty of America. Now, you know, after the Industrial Revolution happened and everyone left farming communities and went into cities, and they traded their property and their land and their slaves and, you know, whatever other sort of thing that made farming life, they traded it for a job and a house and a mortgage. Interestingly, mortgage actually means death contract, literally. So anyway, it's interesting. But it's a great book. It's a classic. It's already a classic book, The Unsettling of America by Wendell Berry. If you guys are interested in the slavery topic, I talked about that. The rise of machines and
Americanization,
you know, industrialization.
It's a good question, and I encourage you. See, what we need to do in the church as well is we need to be historians as well. History is very important, because a lot of people would ask that particular question in university. What about the South? It was Christians who advanced in slavery. And you can say, well, gee whiz, I've actually read something on that, and isn't this interesting? How were the arguments being made by the various camps? And it wasn't as simple as people think it was. They had an argument for the defense of that particular system on the basis of economics and what they thought was good for people, and also they had given an argument from the scriptures. I would just disagree with those arguments, but there was a debate for concerning that. Yeah.
And it's interesting that a Christian, you know, in Europe, William Wilberforce actually ended the slave trade in Europe. He was a white English parliamentarian. And the people who were selling the slaves in Africa were Muslims. Muslims controlled the slave trade. So those are things that you don't learn in the university.
One of the things that I'm thinking of doing when I go back to South Africa is to do my doctoral research on an intersection between Christianity and Islam, and to study potentially study the slave trade in Africa, because when William Wilberforce did his work, it brought to an end slavery in West Africa. Most of the slaves in the United States were from the west coast of Africa, and the Muslims would basically capture the African people, or African tribes would sell them to the Muslims, so you had various tribes taking over other tribes and selling them to the Muslims, and so then they would bring these people to the coast, and the Europeans and others would buy the slaves at the coast, and then they would ship them all over the world. And when William Wilberforce brought slavery to an end, it really only brought slavery on the west coast of Africa to the end, because Africa is a huge continent. You can put North America in Africa three times. That's how huge it is. But when that slavery came to an end, the slave trade on the east coast of Africa continued. Okay, the key thing to bringing the slave trade to an end was the British Navy. Okay, because the British Navy were told once the British had said we're going to bring slave trade to an end, if you find any slave boats and dhows, you just sink them. Okay, so then they started patrolling the coast of West Africa, and they brought the slave trade to an end. Interestingly enough, if you go to Italy, okay, we've worked in Italy, there was a huge slave trade in North Africa where the Muslims would go across the Mediterranean and they would capture people in Southern Europe, and there were a lot of white slaves in North Africa. And in Italy today, a lot of the nursery rhymes, okay, the kids, you know, we sing that song, Ring a Ring a Rosies, Pocket Full of Posies, and then, you know, the kids in the court. Well, that goes back to the plague. And so there's nursery rhymes that they have in Italy which go back to the times where the kids were warned at night to go to bed or be in bed, because if they were outside, these people would come and capture them. Okay, and how that came to an end was when Britain became dominant, it had an amazing navy. They went into the Mediterranean and they went to this Muslim cities in the North Africa, and they basically said to them and said, right, you will stop slave trading here now, or else we're going to shell your cities. And until they would just keep bombing these cities from them. They would just pull the naval ships into position. They would make these treaties. If these people wouldn't comply, they would just shell these cities until they stopped. And that's what brought slave trade in North Africa to an end. Then slave trade in West Africa came to an end. And then the one person, if you want to read an inspirational book, is a book... have you guys heard of David Livingstone? Yeah. Sure. David Livingstone was a missionary in Africa, okay? And he is a very interesting guy. But he was, to some extent, responsible for bringing slave trade to an end on East Africa. And that's what I'm very interested in doing my studies on. Because if you look at Africa, on the coast of East Africa, there's a little island called Zanzibar. And that was the strategic. All the slaves that were in East Africa were captured, most of them by Muslims, brought to the coast of Africa and taken to this island called Zanzibar, where they had a huge slave trading station. You can go there today and you can see the places where they would have the garrisons, where they'd keep all of these slaves. And when David Livingstone was writing his letters back to Britain, he was telling the British people what was going on, because he was watching all of these people getting killed and getting enslaved. And so eventually the British people decided to do something about it. And they sent the Navy, the British Navy, all the way around Africa, because at that stage you couldn't go through the Suez Canal. You had to go all around South Africa. They went onto the east coast of Africa. They went to Zanzibar. And they said to the Muslim leadership, they said, if you don't stop slave trading here now, we're going to sink all of these, the dhows, which is an Arab ship. And it's those dhows that they would get the slaves in Zanzibar, and they would ship them up the coast of East Africa up to Saudi Arabia, where they would sell the slaves. Yeah. It's a fascinating subject, of course, the history of slavery. But a lot of slavery was brought to an end because of Christian people like David Livingstone and people like William Wilberforce. I mean, we have no idea... you really don't understand how God has taken some Christians and done amazing things for them to change things, evil things like slavery. And it's inspiring to read books about those people. As Christians, we need to know that history. It's important that we know that. Right. Okay. Any other questions? Do you have any questions about other religious belief systems? Like, what do Muslims believe? Or what do the cults believe?
A lot of these... How many of you guys have a Mormon friend? Yeah, there's a large Mormon church in the county seat, New Bloomfield.
Okay.
And so, maybe on Mormonism.
Okay.
I have wonderful question. Why all the cheating and everything like that?
What was that, Amanda?
Like, why all the...
Why are there shootings?
Yeah. Because I know somebody that killed themselves and not the driver, so...
So why is it that people are resorting to
violence? Yeah.
Is that directed to just people in general, or is that directed towards
people in general?
In general. Okay. Well, that's a very broad question. Why people decide to go and shoot people? There's a simple answer to that question. It's called sin. That basically people are corrupted, and so they resort to violence in order to achieve certain ends. But then I think that there's a lot of violence that is motivated by particular ideologies, like certain ideas that people are convinced of, they act on those ideas. So I think that a couple of years ago, recent events here in the United States, you had the Sandy Hook shootings. This was in Massachusetts that you had this event?
Connecticut.
And then there was like a guy in I think it was Arizona, who went into a movie house and shot a whole bunch of people. So, yeah, and interestingly enough, I don't know if you remember, a couple of years ago, there was a guy at Virginia Tech who went onto the campus and just locked the doors and went into these classrooms and shot all of these students. We actually went to Virginia Tech like 2 weeks afterwards to go and talk to the students, okay? That was tough ministry, man. We had 150, 200 people there, all of these students who had all these questions about, you know, how do we account for this? What do we do when some guy walks into campus with some firearms and just starts shooting students? And unfortunately, America's got a real problem with a lot of these people who are this extreme violence. And I think that what explains some of those things is the difficulties that some of these people have gone through. Some of these people, I'm told, have problems mentally, psychologically. Sometimes they've been abused. Sometimes there are people who feel like they've been ostracized from their communities, or they might be motivated by political agendas. I think Timothy McVeigh, who was the guy who bombed the buildings in Oklahoma, he was motivated by political concerns. You have this guy in Norway, Breivik, who went around and shot those people a couple of years ago. His explanation for why he did it was because he had a problem with the government and their policies of immigration. And then, of course, you have some violence which is motivated by religious concerns as well. So, for example, amongst Muslims, you see a lot of violent acts going on with shootings, is motivated by a religious ideology. So there's many reasons why people resort to violence, and it's important for us to think about what those reasons are and to grapple with what those things are in order to understand what motivates people to do these terrible things, and then of course to pray against them.
I think that her question touches on probably a really good topic for, given their age, and that is, you know, when I was in high school, it was, you know, 99, you know, that was the first big shooting that happened in Columbine. You know, remember Columbine? Derek Klebold, you know, they killed all these kids. Well, I listened to this lecture about this guy. He's a political philosopher. He asked the same question. He said, why is it that young kids are killing each other? That's scary to think about, right? You guys are all young. You know, I don't know if you have aspirations for going to college. But he said, isn't it interesting that virtually all of these kids were young, they're from affluent families, and they're white? He said, well, what's the theme? He said, well, in, you know, I don't know what it's like for you guys growing up in Christian families, but, you know, a lot of young people nowadays, you know, even young Christian kids, they're exposed to the same things that non-Christian kids are. Only, you know, when they go to college, the reason why we're doing this for you guys is because when you go to college, you meet atheists and secularists, and they say, oh, you can sleep with whoever you want, no consequences.
You can
live however you want, do whatever you want, wherever you want, whatever you want. You know, when I was 18 years old, my cousin, he got into a car with a 20-year-old kid who was drunk, and it breaks my heart to this day. I miss my cousin. We're the same age. We're best friends. And this kid that, you know, was just corrupt, my cousin got into a car with this kid, and they were going 100 miles an hour down a little country road just like this, and they hit another family head-on, this dad and his daughter that, you know, your age. And my cousin died instantly, and so did his friend. What a waste of life. Just drinking? Like, drinking doesn't do anything for you. It's just moral madness. But this guy, this political philosopher, he's asking these questions. He said, why are young kids killing each other? And his answer was that, you know, in public schools and in universities, we teach children nowadays that there's no such thing as goodness. There's no such thing as decency. There's no such thing as beauty. There's no such thing as truth. There's no such thing as morality. There's no such thing as God. There's no such thing as common goodness and morality. And so kids grow up isolated, and they aren't in community or fellowship with anybody. And then the way that they communicate with each other is through social media. And, you know, they have all these images of themselves that they try to portray to other kids to be accepted, to feel like other people love them, to feel like they're, you know, that they have some sort of, like...
meaning and purpose.
Yeah, meaning and purpose. But what's really going on is that they're lonely and they're depressed, and... What that breeds is a major discontent, and that lends itself to hatred, and because at the bottom of it is emptiness. You look at people. I met this lady, and this is touching on a different topic, but I met this lady at this coffee shop in Pittsburgh, where I live closer to Pittsburgh, and this lady told me her brother-in-law was the best eye surgeon in the world. He lived in Washington, D.C. And this eye surgeon was a very wealthy, wealthy, wealthy man. He had everything that you could think of. He had a Ferrari. Everybody in the world, like guys from could come from military, they get their eyes blown off. He put a new one in. This guy had everything you could think of. But you know what was lurking in his life? He didn't believe in God. He was an alcoholic, a raging alcoholic, and he was a rampant homosexual. And you know how this guy's life ended? He hung himself in a garage, drunk himself to death, and pressed his foot on the gas pedal and hung himself by the garage door. That's how this guy's life ended. So you see this garbage in the media about, you know, well, you can, you know, just live your life however you want to and give in to all your desires. Well, you know what that ends? Scripture is right. It ends in death.
Yeah.
That's where it ends. It ends in sorrow and tragedy. And everybody who's gathered together at a funeral is asking the question, well, what happened to this young person? Well, here's how it happened. You know, but that's the subtlety of Satan. And that's the other thing that the university doesn't talk about. You know, there's no such thing as the demonic world. No, it's real. That's why Christ died, you know, to deal with death and sin and evil. And so I encourage you guys, if you go off to college, you know, start studying right now and learning why it is that you really believe what you believe. I wasn't always in this position. I had a difficult life growing up, And I went to seminary because I had a lot of questions. And even after I went to seminary, you know, there was still in my heart what was going on was a lot of insecurity and just in anger and hurt and, you know, being betrayed by other people. And eventually I had to bring those things to Christ because, you know what? It's not just things that people did to me. It's things that I did to other people. And you guys have to reconcile those things. Right now, you're young. Life is fresh. You probably have dreams and passions and desires. And you know what? The only person, everybody in this room, including Simon and me, the thing that we desire more than anything, that at the heart of creation is our longing for God. That is it. The reason why you want sex, the reason why you want good food, the reason why you want peace, the reason why you want fellowship, the reason why you want to fit in with your friends, it's not just because of this world. It's because God made this world. He made it for us. He made it so that we one day could be in fellowship with Him and other people. That's the whole point of this thing. But we're out of fellowship with God. We're out of fellowship with other people. C.S. Lewis said, God, he said, I don't want my idea of God, I want God. I don't want my idea of my neighbor, I want my neighbor. I don't want my idea of myself, I want myself. I don't want my idea of my wife, I want my wife. And so I encourage you guys, like, don't alienate yourself and isolate yourself as you grow up. You know, find true community. Don't find a bunch of friends on Facebook. Find two good friends. That's a challenge, to have two good lifelong friends. C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, they're friends their whole life. When Lewis was an old man, he was dying on his deathbed, you know who visited him? J.R.R. Tolkien. He went to visit him once a week because they were best friends. They were believers and they loved each other. That's true friendship. Those are the friends that you guys need. You need those not just with your parents and right now in life, but seek out those friends, and that'll save you a lot of grief, a lot of pain, a lot of suffering, and a lot of evil.
Yeah, so I would think that the question you raise is the reason why people go out and do these things is because of the absence of these things. And so you've got to understand that even at a young age, you might have friends or people you know of who are suffering from this alienation, ultimate in alienation from God. And so these people in their minds, they have become gods unto themselves. They are the ones who decide that's what's right and wrong. They are the ones who can live as they wish. And that's what our universities tell them, you know. And, you know, what's true for you is true for you, and what's true for me is true for me. That's what they say at the colleges. Well, if that's true, then whatever you think is true for you, that's how you live your life. You become the god of your life. You decide what's right. You decide what's good, you decide what's virtuous, and you live it out. And nobody dare challenge you, you know?
Until somebody gets shot.
And then everybody's outraged, and then they wonder why this is happening. And I'm thinking, we breed a culture and we shape a culture that by extension leads to these consequences. And then we stand around like fools and go, I wonder how this happened. I wonder why these things happened. No, we are actually building a culture which perpetuates that kind of actions from individual, because this is a bankruptcy of these things that are intrinsic to human beings. That we are created for a specific purpose, you know. That we aren't gods, as some people would like you to think, okay. And that we're here ultimately for a specific end, you know. I in one of the things that I learned at the seminary. We talk a lot about the end of things, what things are destined for. So you might consider, for example, what is the end of an acorn? What is an acorn destined to become? An oak tree, okay? So you see an acorn, what is its end? It's meant to become a big oak tree somewhere in the field, okay? Here's a question you want to ask yourself. What is your end? We know what the end of a fish is. A trout egg lying in a river. What is the end? It's the end, or a salmon. It's to become this fish that grows up, goes into the ocean, and at the end of its life it comes up and lays its eggs, and you have the cycle. We can ask exactly the same question about ourselves. What is our end? And a lot of people are confused about that or alienated from it. And some people don't even think there is an end to it. They think that life is meaningless. Some of the philosophy that we have to read, okay, is written by people who are atheists and agnostics. These guys understand that if there is no God, then there's no such thing as an end. Life is just random. Our science departments tell you what? Evolution is true. What are your cousins? Okay? Your cousins are some pond scum, some bacteria somewhere. Now what does that do in terms of how you think about your own life and destiny?
It makes it pretty bleak.
It makes it pretty bleak. And then they run it out. They think, well, what's the point of living? Let me go and hang myself, or let me go and kill a whole bunch of people and then shoot myself at the end of it. And this is what explains some of the violent things. So some of these things are because of this bankruptcy, and some of these things are motivated by religious convictions. Yes, Adam.
Can you go ahead and just do some definitions, like in terms of who's an atheist?
Okay.
What's an agnostic? Okay. And also, I think maybe just talking about whether to do that first, and then I'll ask another question.
Okay. Okay, so an atheist is a person who believes that there is no God, and an agnostic is someone who says, "I don't know. I don't know if there is a God." So atheism is a stronger claim. Okay, atheism is saying that there is no God. It believes that we can argue that there is no existence of God. The agnostic is saying, well, I don't know. I don't think that we can know whether there is one or there isn't one. Okay.
And the agnostic also would say that there is a God, but you may not be able to know him.
Yeah, so they would just say, well, I don't know the answer to that question. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then the theist would say that there is a God. There is God. Okay. Now, under theism, okay, you would have different kinds of theists. Okay. You would have monotheists. Okay. And those are people who believe that there is a God, but there's one God. And out of this, you're going to have three major world religions: Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. My handwriting is excellent. It's good. Yeah. All right, that's monotheism. And then you might have other kinds of theists. You've got yes. You have other kinds of theism as well. You've got other belief systems. You have Hinduism. Hinduism believes that there are many gods, so they're polytheists. You would have other belief systems like Buddhism. Now, Buddhism is interesting because Buddhism actually came out of Hinduism, okay? So it broke out of Hinduism, almost like a sect or a cult. Like Mormonism and Jehovah's Witnesses comes out of Christianity, okay? Mormonism began around 1820, and the founder of Mormonism is a guy by the name of Joseph Smith. The Jehovah's Witnesses began, I think it was Charles Taze Russell, 1867, okay, in New York, was the founder. So these are breakaway groups from Christianity. In Islam, for example, okay, you have breakaway groups. A lot of religions have the original religion, and then the groups break away, and they become different groups and different sects, like Buddhism out of Hinduism. In Islam, you've also got cults of Islam, like you've got the Nation of Islam here in the United States. It's an American phenomenon with Louis Farrakhan and these guys. It's called the Nation of Islam. You've also got the Baha'i. Okay? They're a breakaway splinter group from... like in Judaism, you have different schools of thinking in Judaism. And in Christianity as well, you've got cults. You've got Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses and many other cults as well. But that happens with all other belief systems. Okay? So under theism, you would also have... some of these belief systems are what they call pantheism. pantheism is different from theism. Theism believes that there is a God. Pantheism holds that the world is God. Okay? All right? So a lot of belief systems, a lot of religions are pantheistic. They believe that the world, that the universe is actually God. Okay? And so by extension, okay, you are also God. Why? Because you are part of this world. So who knows Oprah Winfrey here? Okay? You've all heard of Oprah Winfrey. What is her belief system? She's a pantheist. Okay? She believes that you and I are ultimately, we're little gods. Very interesting. Mormons. Okay? Even though it came out of Christianity. Mormons are polytheists. Okay? Mormons believe that ultimately, as you go through this system, okay, you're going to become a god. Okay? This is standard Mormon theology, okay, which is very strange, extremely strange. Because here's the question you could ask a Mormon, for example: how does a person become a god? And why would I want to worship something that becomes a god? Seems like there's a problem with that. We believe in Christianity that God doesn't change. That he's always been what he is from eternity. He didn't become a god. There was no gods before him. He's eternal. That's part of his nature. In Mormonism, God became a god. Jesus is a man who became a god. And each person gets their own universe. And you will ultimately, in Mormonism, as you progress up the scales, you will become a god yourself. That's what Mormons believe. A lot of Mormons, when you meet them at their home, they're not going to talk about this stuff. But if you dig down into Mormon theology, that's what you're going to get. Okay? And so these are important questions. When the Mormons show up at your door, if you start doing a bit of research on Mormonism, you can begin to learn about what they believe. In this area, you're probably going to have Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses as you study and learn. There's some good books on the table out there. There's an introduction to Mormonism. If you learn a few questions, and when they show up at your door next time, you can say, you know, I'm very interested. Could you explain to me, what you believe and why would you believe this? Okay? And that begins a conversation. But it's going to challenge you to think about your faith then. Okay? So those are the basic systems then. You've got atheism. There's basically three main worldviews. There's atheism, there's theism, and there's pantheism. Any religious system, a non-religious system, will fit into one of those categories. Okay? And so that gives you the big picture of what all worldviews will fit into one of these categories. And so when you're talking to somebody, a great way to engage them is to begin to ask them questions so that you can begin to find out what their system is. And as you study apologetics, you'll find out what are some of the central tenets of atheism or agnosticism. Okay? So let me give you an example. When you're at university, you'll meet a lot of people, okay, who are, they call themselves either atheists or agnostics. Okay? I meet a lot of college students that say, oh, I'm an atheist, but when you actually start talking to them, they're actually an agnostic. They don't know the difference between an atheist and an agnostic. So you help them say, okay, so you're an agnostic. Yeah, I must be an agnostic then. But once you get to their agnosticism, then you can begin to ask them further questions about their belief systems. So what we've had instances of evangelism at universities. We were at Clemson University, and some guys came up to me and said, you know, we were Christians, I went to church, and we just don't believe Christianity anymore, it's absurd. You people believe in crazy things, like you believe like a dead man can rise from the dead. You believe that, a donkey can speak. You know, this is crazy. So I said to him, I said, yeah, I understand it. From your worldview, from your understanding, those things are pretty crazy, because as an atheist or a materialist, you don't think that those things are supernatural. I said, but from my view, I have an agency that can account for that. We have a supernatural being. Our worldview entails the belief that God exists. And if God exists, then you can't rule out the possibility of miracles. But then I turned the question. I said to him, what I find interesting about your worldview is you have to believe in some things, but you don't have that are tantamount to miracles, but you don't have anything to explain it. And they're like, well, what are you talking about? I said to them, okay, here's two things. Number one, you have to believe that the universe came from nothing. Okay? Because you have nothing to explain the universe. So what's more reasonable to believe? The universe came from nothing, or the universe came from something? How does something come from nothing?
Answer, it can't.
It can't. How can something be prior to itself? That's philosophically daft. They begin to feel the weights now, because now I'm asking, and I did this with as much grace as possible. I'm saying to you, I don't know how you reconcile it. You know, your own cosmologists are telling you that the universe came from nothing. How can nothing explain the universe? And in more important, when you talk about how this universe came from this singularity, all scientific laws break down at that point. So what do you have? You have a supernatural state of affairs. None of your physics applies to that event. Then I asked him this question. I said to him, you also have to believe that life comes from non-life. We're told in your biology classes, if you study evolution, what happens? Prior to life existing, there was the earth, and then there was some chemicals floating around, and then there was lightning and warm temperatures, and suddenly a little bacteria formed. And that's your great-great-great-grandfather back then. You know? That's what they tell you. So I asked him this question. I said to him, I said, when you are studying science, You come across people like, who knows who Louis Pasteur was? Yes, what is Pasteur famous for?
Making it so there weren't bacteria and stuff like in milk and wine and stuff.
Okay, so you live in a country where you make a lot of milk. The problem is if you don't pasteurize milk, which is where Pasteur comes from, it can make you ill, okay? And previously, people believed that life could spontaneously generate. Well, when Louis Pasteur had done his work, they realized you don't get living things from a sterile environment. Engineers who build sterilization equipment work on the assumption that you don't get life from non-life. Yet the atheist has to believe what? That you get life from non-life. So who's doing the science now? You have to believe that life comes from non-life. And further, you have to believe that these complex biological systems, which are full of information, okay, that just comes by random. I said to him, how do you explain that? You have nothing to give an account for that, or nothing that's intellectually satisfying, in my opinion. I said to him, so whilst some of the things I believe might be strange to you, I at least have an agency to explain. We have a dead man here. We have a supernatural God that can give life to dead man. I think that that's plausible. You have to believe some things for which there is no cause. Your answers to those questions, in my opinion, are intellectually absurd.
What's interesting too about the Christian faith is that, like pre-Christian, pre-Christ, Aristotle, Socrates, and Plato, and the Greek philosophers, they argued for the existence of God without invoking any Christian worldview. Aristotle argued for the existence of God.
It's a philosophical.
So you can actually argue, as a Christian, you can actually argue for the existence of God without using the Bible at all. The Bible is just like icing on the cake. It's like, okay, Aristotle argued for God, and then Christianity came along, and when Paul is arguing he's arguing in Athens, and there's a section in Acts where he's arguing. He's talking about the Greek philosophers, and Paul's saying, "This is the God that you're all talking about. This is the God. This is the God, the Christian God, Christ, the God incarnate." So it's actually really, I mean, Christianity, it has it all. Like you can philosophically, you can argue for the existence of God, yeah. And then supernaturally, you know, explaining the resurrection. That's the other thing I was going to add to what Simon was saying, was that the resurrection of Christ, there is so much historical evidence for it. It's unbelievable. If you want to hang your hat on something, study the resurrection. It's overwhelming, the evidence for it. when you really get into it, there's a if you're interested, Gary Habermas, he's a professor at Liberty University. He has a PhD from Michigan State University.
Yeah, this is
and he's a world-renowned scholar on the resurrection.
That there is a brilliant book on the resurrection. You've got it in your library, yeah. It's an absolutely brilliant book on the resurrection. I encourage you to read that book, where they look at the resurrection from a historic perspective, and you see everybody else. You can pass it around.
Get it. Yeah.
So we can give an argument for the existence of God. Okay, so everything that has a beginning has a cause. The universe had a beginning. What is the conclusion? Therefore, the universe has a cause. That's an argument. It's a philosophical argument. Arguing for a first cause.
There's cosmological evidence and philosophical evidence.
Well, Simon, when you take people to that point and say, you know, when the universe had to have a beginning and that is God, and then they always come back with, well, where did God come from?
Okay, that's a good question. Who made God? Okay. Have you heard that question before?
Now, and I'd be interested. These guys just finished Stephen Meyer's True View.
Yes.
And so they should be able to answer that question.
Yeah. Well, in Stephen Meyer's book, and I know Stephen Meyer, yeah. We've worked a lot with him, so he's going to give scientific arguments. Yeah. This is a philosophical argument. He's going to give you evidence for a designer from the complexity and design of life. Sorry, yes.
I have another question. Like, I talked to different people about God. They're like, don't tell me the different gods. I don't know what to believe.
Okay, so if I catch it right, is the question then that you speak to people and people believe that there are different kinds of gods?
Yeah, and okay. I don't know what to believe in now.
Okay, that's a good question. The question then is, so why think it's the Christian God? Okay, because as we've heard from the other scribbles I made on here, which you all remember very clearly, okay, because I write so clearly, and that there's a lot of different belief systems, and there's people who believe in different kinds of gods. So why do we believe in the God of the Bible? Okay, all right? That's a great question, and we can navigate and begin to sift through the various views of God by thinking about the question of, if there is a God, what would that God be like? Okay. So let's use this argument here. Let's see if we can figure out something about the nature of God from these things. Okay. And the scripture talks about this. In Romans chapter 1, it says this. It says, the wrath of God has been revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Listen very carefully. It says, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power, and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. In the book of Romans, Paul says that we can know something about the nature of God from the things that have been made. We can know something about the nature of God from creation. In your series you did with True You, with Stephen Meyer, you were learning something about the nature of God by looking at creation and how amazingly it's been designed. Is that true?
And if you're still questioning it, go watch Planet Earth.
Yeah. We can also learn something about the nature of God. So we can learn something about the nature of God through science. We see this amazing complexity and you go, wow, whatever designed that is amazing. Okay. We look at technology and you think, wow, this is an amazing contraption over here. You know, how amazing is this? This has nothing in terms of information and design on a human cell. You think that Apple or these Steve Jobses are capable? They marvel at the amount of information that can be stored in one DNA strand. And every single cell in your body has this DNA strand, which is this information system that is huge. We have nothing in our technology that can compress that amount of information into that size. It's unbelievable. And what's interesting about the DNA is it reads in both directions. Isn't that crazy? It's like having a book. You can read information this way, and if you read backwards, it also reads another thing. Isn't that amazing? So that's sort of like a design argument for the existence of God, and from that we can know that the designer is amazingly complex. Okay, but philosophically we can also know that everything it has a beginning has a cause. The universe had a beginning, okay, therefore the universe has a cause. So what can we know about what the nature of this cause is? Okay, what kind of cause is the cause of the universe? Well, we can know this. If given the size of the universe, okay, the cause would have to be endowed with at least tremendous power. Unfathomable power. To put the universe into existence, you're going to need a God kind of power. So we know that whatever the cause of the universe has crazy amount of power. In theology, we call this omnipotence. Okay? Since what is explaining what is, okay, and everything that we have is matter, then what explains it can't be material itself. It has to be immaterial. God is spirit. Spirit isn't material. You can't say matter explains matter, because then you get this infinite regress and you keep asking the question. So whatever explains the world and the universe, material things, has itself to be immaterial. Okay? Since the universe is also creator of things and time is a function of motion and things, whatever that being is, it also has to be outside of time. It has to be eternal. Which means that whatever this being is, it didn't come to be. Because if it came to be, it would be something like the universe. So we can know, through reflecting upon the creation, we can know something about the attributes of God. These are some of the very basic attributes of God. So when the New Age people say, oh, you become a God, my question is, no. Because that means I can't become something. The God that I worship, that's worthy of my worship, is an eternal being. He didn't become anything. Necessarily, he had to exist prior to the creation of the universe. So Paul says here in Romans, we can know, since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power, and his divine nature, which is some of these things, eternality and immateriality, have been clearly seen, been understood from what has been made. We can know something about the nature of God from the created order. Suppose there was a piano over here, okay? We could look at the piano, and we could know something about the guy who made the piano by examining the piano. What is a piano typically made out of? Wood. So what would we say, what attributes would the piano maker have? You'd have to have some kind of carpentry skills. But a piano is also what? What is it? It's a musical instrument. So he would also have to have some kind of musical skills. So what are we doing? We're inferring attributes regarding the maker of the piano. We do this with everything. We can do exactly the same thing because God has given us a mind to look at creation and infer something about the nature of God by examining creation. Because God has given us two revelations. He's given us his word, which reveals to us something about who he is and his dealings with people. But he's also given us creation, which tells us something about who he is. So we can discover something about the nature of God from examining creation. So through philosophy, we can come to know about God. Through science, we can come to know about God. Through history, we can come to discover who Jesus is. And then through his word, we can also come to know about who God is. Now, the good thing about the scriptures is the scriptures is very detailed. It gives us a lot of information about God. You know, it's God's revelation, God giving information of himself to us through the scriptures or through the creation. So to answer your question then, we can know something about the nature of God from the things that have been made. And if God has some of these kinds of attributes, then any religious system that disagrees with these attributes, I would say is false. And it's not just because I'm not a Hindu. I just disagree with their view of God. And so that's the reason why I'm not a Hindu. I'm a Christian. Why? Because I'm convinced, based off of my experience of reality and creation and what I find in the scriptures, I find that those things are true. Number one, about my experience and about the things that seem reasonable to me. And so I think that the Christian conception of God, okay, is correct. That there isn't multiple gods, there's only one God. When you get to university, they're going to ask the kind of questions to you that this young lady asked. What is your name?
Amanda.
Amanda, yeah. Good, great question. They're going to ask you, why do you believe in the Christian conception of God? Why do you think that that is true? What about the Hindus? And if you have some basic understanding of some of these arguments, you can begin to ask them questions and say to them, well, you know, we can know something about the nature of God from creation. That's what the Bible says in the book of Romans. You can even show them this verse. It says here we can know something about what God is like, that he's tremendously powerful and that he has some of these attributes. So does that help you then? Great question.
Thank
Any
you.
Other questions? Any other questions then? Yes, ma'am.
I just have a quick question.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of in the sciences, and it's been coming up lately that like I was reading in one of my college textbooks that the destruction of science by Christianity. So like a lot of my professors are bringing up that like in the 18th century and Dark Ages that Christianity kind of shunned science. So I was like, oh no. So how is the best way to defend Christianity? That Christianity does not, like, reject science, but...
Right. I can't believe
that
that's what you've been told.
Yeah, that's
right. That is so...
All the Christians.
That is so patently false.
Yeah.
That it's almost absurd that they're raising
it. Yeah, it's a lie.
What's your name, man?
Montana.
Okay, you have a great opportunity here to gracefully show these people how wrong they are. The foundation of science is a function of the church, okay? Ask him whether Isaac Newton was a Christian or not.
Or Kepler.
Or Blaise Pascal. Or Louis Pasteur.
Or Galileo.
All these men.
Or Copernicus.
All of these people who are the giants of science, what were they? They were all Christians. So what you need to do, and I can actually give you, I know a book which lists out all of these scientists. And they're all believers. And said to them, if Christianity undermines science, isn't it strange that all these people were Christians? That seems absurd. Okay.
Yeah, they always go back to like the church shunning like new ideas of like you know the earth revolves around the sun or things like that.
Okay, let's examine that for a moment. Okay, so what? Remind me of your name again.
Montana.
Okay, so we're talking about. This period, yeah. The church is shutting down science and thinking and all that kind of thing. Okay?
Francis Crick was the other big one.
Yeah. Okay. And I'm going to find out. There's a book that's been written on this subject. So when you finish, I'm going to give you my details, and I'm going to email you a link to a book that discusses this issue. Okay, here's what happened, okay? In the 1500s, there was a big debate about the question of does... Everything, this is the earth, does everything revolve and rotate around the earth? Okay? Like, you know, there's a sun and everything else, okay? And there was, the main view was that the earth was stationary and everything is revolving around the earth. Okay? That is called the geocentric view. Everybody believed that. All the science pointed towards that. And so the church also held to this view. Why? Because the science of the day said that this is what's going on. Then along come two people, Copernicus, and about 100 years later, a guy by the name of Galileo. Now Copernicus says, well, this model seems to have some problems, okay? Because when they were mapping out this model, it wasn't accounting for certain things. And so he came up with a theory and said, no, well, perhaps what is the case then is the sun is stationary and the earth is rotating around the sun. And other planets and things are rotating around the sun. So it was a new theory which was in opposition to the predominant theory. The church was just in agreement with what the science of the day was. So Copernicus comes up with a theory, but he couldn't answer certain questions, objections to it. Galileo comes along about 100 years later, and what does he invent? Telescope. He makes a telescope. There's his telescope. Okay. There's the eyepiece at the back. There's Galileo. Okay. There he is there. Happy chap. He looks to the telescope and he looks at some of the planets, and what does he see revolving around those planets? He sees moons revolving around those planets. So the conclusion is, well, if everything revolves around the Earth, what are the moons doing revolving around these planets? So he has evidence. So now the geocentrists have to deal with it. Well, we thought everything revolved around the Earth. Well, hang on, here's some moons revolving around something else. So Galileo comes along. He presents evidence to challenge the theory, to support Copernicus's heliocentric view. Helio means sun, heliocentrism. Okay? So this is just a normal discussion that happened in science departments. He had various objections leveled against him, and ultimately with the development of physics, who's the father of physics? Newton. Newton was a profoundly religious man, a Christian man. In fact, if I'm memory serves okay, he wrote more about his faith than he did about science.
And the angels.
Yeah. So he came along and he was a genius, and they begin to have physics, and the physics was eventually coming behind and supporting this view to explain the model. And that's when you have this paradigm shift from geocentrism to heliocentrism. And eventually the church moved that way. But the church was merely in agreement with what the popular consensus was. They weren't railing against these guys. They were just saying, look, these are the views of the science of our day. Or what do we have going on in the university today? Everybody agrees with what? What theory? Evolution. And you dare not challenge evolution. They're behaving just like the church behaved about geocentrism in the same way. But when we challenge this thesis, what do they call us? They call us ignorant people. So a basic investigation into the history of science and the philosophy of science will just demonstrate to you that what these people are saying, telling you is just simply false. It misunderstands the whole Galileo controversy and what was going on. And number two, it's not the case that the church is just trying to shut this down. The church was saying, well, this is what the scholars are saying, so the consensus is this, so we support that particular view. It was eventually overthrown because of the genius of Copernicus and Galileo and Newton, and physics came in to deal with the objections. But eventually the evidence proved that what? Heliocentrism is true. And it's not the case that everything revolves around the sun. We know that what? The sun is a part of a spiral galaxy. So if you look at our galaxy, it sort of looks something like this. And our sun is over here, and so whilst this planet's revolving around that, the whole galaxy is actually turning. And then outside of our galaxy, there's billions of other galaxies. So everything's in motion. So I think that this is a fantastic opportunity for you to gracefully go in there and just do a bit of research and then learn a few things and go and ask some good questions. And maybe you can just put a pebble in their shoes when they're walking in. I'm like, man, they can ask me. I don't know how to deal with this. That's what we've got to learn to do, is study these things. Like this young man here. I encourage you to learn more about the issue of slavery in this country, because I think people are deeply ignorant of it. And you can say, well, I've actually read something about that, and isn't this interesting? I'll send you a link to that book. Great question. All right. Is this somewhat helpful, folks? And we're going to be here for a while, so if you have any other questions, do feel free to come up to myself, or Benjamin, or Ray, or my wife, or Benjamin's wife, who are going to be around here. If you've got any more questions you want to ask them, maybe it's related to ethics, where you want questions about, you know, some of the ethical issues in our day, euthanasia or abortion or those kinds of things, or you want to ask questions about other religions or what other people believe, or questions about the Bible or something like that. That's what we've got to do. Are we down for time, Andy?
I think we're.
Finished. Okay. Well, shall we close in a word of prayer? Okay, let's do that. Let me ask Benjamin, do you want to close us in a word of prayer?
Sure. Gracious Lord and Heavenly Father, I am so thankful to be here and to fellowship with these young minds. Lord, I pray, my prayer today is that you protect them from evil and sin all the days of their life. I pray that you would give them a few friends. I pray that you would help them to learn and to study all the great things that there are to learn, and that they would at the same time read the scriptures every day of their life, and that if they choose to have families, they would love their children, and that they would change the American landscape again for your glory. And I pray that they would keep their faith and that they would trust you with all of their hearts, and that they would know that even though youth is fleeting, as the scriptures say, that they would long for heaven and all of the beauty and goodness and hope that the scriptures tell us that it is, and that they would never lose sight of Christ, and that they would continually have in the forefront of their minds and heart that you are the thing that they long for the most. You are the thing that their hearts are yearning for and hoping for, because you are the author of all goodness and truth and beauty and life. And I pray, Lord, that you would give them a community of friends, and that they would find it in real people and not online, and that they would just trust you, Lord, and that they would forgive others when they're wrong, and that they would forgive themselves. And